Hi, I'm Carla.
And I'm Kristen. We are the co-hosts of Perimenopause OMG. We're friends, moms, wives, and athletes.
And we're going through some stuff.
That stuff is called perimenopause.
OMG, you guys, no one talks about it.
Till now. We're here to talk about all of it.
The good, the bad, the ugly, and the funny.
So sit back and relax.
Hold on to your butts.
Enjoy the episode.
Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Carla.
How you doing?
I'm good. How's your week going?
It's going really well. I'm a little busy with all, you know, things work, but it's moving along. What about you?
Yeah. We're good. You know, post-holiday, post-festivities, we're just trying to get back into the routine. This week we had a bunch of just, like, random things on the calendar, so that's always tricky when, like, you're used to your routine and...
Totally.
Like, different, like, good things, like, you know, extra activities, but it just kind of throws your head for a spin.
Absolutely.
So. 100%.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So, all good. Just, you know, in the craziness of the fall or the winter season.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then, but it's 2023 now, so now we can, like, officially start counting down to Memorial Day, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say it's like 20 weeks.
Okay.
It's about 20 weeks.
But so. Who's counting, right?
Me.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. To remind our listeners, we live in Pennsylvania, where winter is from December to
March,
April-ish.
Yeah.
It just depends. And Pennsylvania now, compared to when we were younger, is like a muddy winter. Mm-hmm. It's not really that cold. It's not like beautiful, snowy Utah, where you can like ski down the mountain and go to your house. It's just like mud and murk and dark.
Right.
And
right.
Depression.
Right. Unless you go, like, to the Poconos, and then it's fun for a little trip, but...
Right. For people who like to go outside and be cold.
Yes.
Which is not me. So so I'm just going to count down till spring and summertime.
Yes. We will get some snow days. We will get some ski days, some sledding days, but still, after Memorial Day is my time.
Yep. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Same. So this episode is a really special episode to me because in the past year, in 2022, I had a few friends who were diagnosed with different cancers or, mm-hmm. you know, precancerous situations. I've also had friends that had their parents diagnosed with cancer or die from certain cancers. And I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, but my father died of a cancer called cholangiocarcinoma, which is essentially a microscopic tumor that spreads very quickly to your pancreas. My father died when he was diagnosed when he was 45. Mm. So he was very young. So cancer screening is a big deal to me and my family.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the mid-40s.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So with my friends that have been going through the diagnosis and the treatment aspect, they were diagnosed at an early, early stage. And that's because they took preventative measures and... Mm-hmm. Went and got their mammograms and their pap smears and, you know, their colonoscopies. So today on the episode, we are inviting on Hedel Vig. And Hedel and I actually worked together years ago, like 20 years ago at Fox Chase Cancer Center. And Hedel is a certified genetic counselor. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of a genetic counselor, Kristen?
I didn't know much about it before we spoke with Hedel.
Yeah.
You know, so it was really good information to find out and, you know, just really good to hear about the types of like preventative care and monitoring and things that you can do to try to figure out, you know, your choices for what's happening and what's going on.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And not every cancer is hereditary. Mm-hmm. So HEDL sort of deals with hereditary genetic cancers. Cancer does come from a change in the DNA, so it is all genetic. Mm-hmm. But it's not all of them are hereditary. Most of them are environmental, at least mixed with an environmental component. I'm excited for everyone to hear what HEDL has to say, because when I think of cancer, or when I used to think of cancer, you know, the C word, it would scare me. Mm-hmm. And the older I get, and the more information that I have, and the more I can take control of screening, mm-hmm. for different cancers, mm-hmm. The more I feel empowered. Mm-hmm. And like HEDL says in this episode, boils down to knowledge is power. So
yeah, and the ability to make choices and figure out the choices that are best for you.
For you and your family.
And whatever situation you're in.
Yeah.
So the C word can now be choices.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Welcome, HEDL Vig, to Perimenopause OMG.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Carla.
HEDL, can you please tell our audience who you are and what you do and sort of like your educational background?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I'm very happy to be here on Perimenopause OMG. I am a board certified genetic counselor. I primarily specialize in cancer for the past 20 years, counseling both men and women who are at higher risk for hereditary cancers based on their personal or family history. And I have also been involved in education and training of students, and was part of the Rutgers Genetic Counseling Program and helped started their program, and was assistant professor at Rutgers and part of their genetic counseling program, as well as the associate director of the Brandeis Genetic Counseling Program prior to my current role at Foundation Medicine, where I'm a clinical genomics specialist. So I've crossed many sectors over many years.
HEDL, you've been a genetic counselor for 20 years?
Yes, mm-hmm. 20 years.
Oh my gosh, before we started recording, I was like, HEDL, you look so good, but my goodness, girl, you really don't age. You don't age.
I don't know about that, but thank you.
Before we get into the importance of genetic counseling, especially during perimenopause, I'd like to tell our listeners how we know each other. So we met, was my first job, yep. right out of graduate school. We had moved to Pennsylvania. I mean, my first job out of grad school was a cocktail waitress.
Of course.
And that was really fun. But I knew I had to use my my degree at some point. So
I had the opportunity to interview Carla, who had a different last name back then.
I did. That's right. It was Mazar. No, Mazaropause doesn't work.
So it doesn't work. It's good that you got married.
You're in menopause now.
Yeah.
But that's right.
Yep.
I like came out of the interview and I was like, this is great. Interviewing so easy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we worked together and then, yeah. you know, eventually we both left those positions and I realized that interviewing is not, in fact, that easy. But that was a really fun job.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. And we,
one of the research studies we did was internet.
Yep. Internet.
Virtual counseling. And that was like a big deal.
Wow.
We were like on the forefront of that. And now look. Could you imagine?
I know. Well, I was just thinking about that. I was like, you know, back, whatever, 20 years ago, like we were thinking that this was revolutionary. Right. That this is just like this innovative, you know, modality. And now it's like the world that we live in every day.
So let's get into some of the meat of our conversation. So for myself and for our listeners who, you know, might not really know what a genetic counselor does or who do they see, can you explain a little bit of that for us?
Sure. So genetic counselors are master's trained health professionals. We get our degree in training in different specialties of genetics, cancer genetics, prenatal genetics, pediatrics, and there are many, many more now. And we also have a extensive training in psychosocial counseling and communication of complex information to patients that in a way that they can actually understand very complex concepts and tailor them to fit their needs and decisions that they often have to make once they have genetic testing and are faced with, you know, several decision points, and whether it's for themselves and deciding whether or not they need to take proactive steps to reduce their risk of cancer, or if they have children that they are also concerned about in terms of passing it on to their children. Mm-hmm. So there's various facets to genetic counseling, but typically the referrals that we get are for individuals who may have breast or ovarian cancer, or other potentially hereditary cancers, including uterine, pancreatic cancers. And a lot of the spectrum is kind of expanding as we understand more about the hereditary basis of several cancers. And I would say 95% of our referrals are through a physician. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we get self-referrals. In other words, we get referrals because a patient or an unaffected person who doesn't have cancer is just worried about their risk based on their family history, and they want someone who's specialized to do an assessment, you know, based on their family history and see is it tracking in a way that makes us suspicious that there is something hereditary going on and genetic testing is warranted. So that's typically why people come to us in general.
So you're helping them like kind of process that genetic information and understand the risks, or help them make the decisions and like weigh the pros and cons of what that information brings to them.
Exactly. Yeah. So we often believe, at least, especially in cancer genetics, that knowledge is power. So if we knew that someone was at high risk for certain types of cancers, there are things they can do, either screening, high-risk screening, or taking medicine to reduce their risk. Or some women decide to, you know, remove healthy tissue, breast tissue, ovarian tissue, so that they don't have that risk. So it's truly preventative. Wrapping their head around all of this information that has so much impact, and both emotional impact and physical impact to themselves and potentially to their family, is, you know, a lot to kind of navigate.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So we try to aid in that as much as we can.
And Hedl, would you say that now, you know, 20 years later from when I worked with you,
right,
would you say that a lot of physicians, or specifically OBGYNs, are well-versed in the world of genetic counseling and will go ahead and, you know, see these signs of hereditary risk and move forward with a referral?
That's a really good question. And I think that they've come a long way in 20 years. And I think when, you know, when they see a young woman, you know, less than 45 with breast cancer, they see, for example, maybe a Jewish person with breast cancer at any age, or ovarian cancer at any age, I think they're pretty good at referring. Some OBGYNs also perform the test. They feel so well-versed that some of them are performing the test. And then they get something that they don't understand, and then they refer.
Okay.
So there's different modes. And I think as genetic counselor, we understand that we can't be the all-time gatekeepers of all of this information, that this information is going to come from various sources, whether it's a physician, whether it's a nurse, whether it's a direct-to-consumer testing, you know,
we'll get there.
You know, there are so many various forms of and modalities where individuals are getting information nowadays, the internet.
Yeah, right.
So we have to be mindful that that is the way of the world, and that patients have to still navigate what information they've been given and what information we can help them navigate further and make sure we're separating what's truth and what's maybe myth.
Sure. So you're definitely the person to contact if there is a big question, even if they got a result from something like direct to consumer, you can still answer questions.
Yes. Yeah.
In an appointment.
Right.
That's good.
So we are kind of, you know, see ourselves as specialized and trained in this area. So if anyone needs our assistance, we're there to help serve them in whatever shape and form they need it at that juncture.
And this is just sort of a follow-up to that. We would find, so let's say there's a young woman who was just diagnosed with breast cancer and she wants to contact a genetic counselor. Genetic counselors, many of them work in hospitals.
Yeah, I would say that the majority still work in hospitals, especially within cancer. You'll find at major medical centers, even community hospitals, will likely have employed a genetic counselor. There may not be 15 of them, but there may be, you know, one or two employed, just because of how frequently these indications come up in any oncology practice. If you can imagine how many individuals have breast cancer, there's a, you know, if 10% of them are being referred because they have a potential, at least 10% are being referred, right? Because they actually can have a mutation in one of these high-risk genes, but probably, you know, 30 to 40% are actually meeting criteria, right?
Right.
Trim down to that. So it's a lot of people to see.
So then, you know, if a patient does reach out to you, whether it's, you know, with their own information that they're bringing to you, or they have questions for you, or they want to, you know, go reach out to you for genetic testing, you know, through you, what does a typical genetic counseling appointment look like?
So that's a great question. So once they're referred to us, so say it's kind of the traditional model where they come in, they've never had testing. They usually have an initial genetic counseling appointment, and that usually will take almost an hour or so. And that initial genetic appointment will consist of the genetic counselor taking their medical history, you know, basic medical history, especially related to cancer screening and reproductive history, as well as a detailed three-generation pedigree, which is not for dogs, but it's a family history. And we just extend that out three generations to really capture the full family history. Because as you can imagine, you know, if there are a lot of males or if there are individuals who don't have siblings, you really need to go further to really grasp how things are tracking in the families. And then we assess the person's risk based on that family history. Are we seeing patterns of cancer? Are we seeing breast and ovarian, prostate cancer on the same side of the family, some at young ages, younger than we expect, like younger than age 50, that gives us a signal. Maybe there's some sort of either BRCA gene mutation in the family, or maybe other high-risk breast or ovarian genes, susceptibility genes that might be playing a role in that family history. And that's when we would order genetic testing. Once our suspicion is high that there is something on that side of the family, we would want to do genetic testing. And usually that's done at that same appointment. Pre-authorization for the genetic testing and the blood sample kind of go together in one shot. And so that process has started, and which is really important because individuals who have breast cancer, for example, may be awaiting surgery decisions as to whether or not they need to have a double mastectomy or a lumpectomy.
Sure.
And so they need that fast. And then once the results come back, that could be a second session in person, or oftentimes these days it's by phone, telemedicine, all kinds of different models. Even the initial sessions are sometimes telemedicine now.
So if a patient's coming to you for the first time, they really need to gather that family information first. I know sometimes we don't, at least, in my experience, I don't necessarily know my great grandmother's, medical history, but talking to those family members who are still with us and trying to find out as much information, several generations back is really important for you.
Yeah, at least two generations back, and knowing about your cousins on both sides of the family, maternal and paternal, dad's side does matter, especially when it comes to family histories. And I usually encourage patients to do is, oftentimes there is a historian in the family. And if that person can be contacted before you come and you can kind of gather information from that person, oftentimes you're getting, pretty thorough family history.
Hedel, what happens after a patient gets their genetic results? When you're BRCA positive, or BRCA1 positive or BRCA2 positive, that's a true positive, and you would recommend, screening?
Yeah, so we would recommend if you're found to be positive for a mutation, a cancer-causing mutation in, say, BRCA1, you are at high risk. A female is at high risk for both breast and ovarian cancer.
Hedel, can you just say what high risk means?
Yeah, so high risk basically means higher than the average woman's risk. So if the average woman's risk for breast cancer is about 12%, those who have a BRCA1 mutation, their risk can be as high as 85% compared to 12%. So quite high. And then for ovarian cancer, the risk can range from 20 to oftentimes as high as 40 to 60% compared to less than 2% in the average woman.
That's significant.
So that's very significant. So because those risks are so high, we do have very specific recommendations for individuals who test positive. So for females, we recommend at minimum that they're getting breast MRI and mammogram. So we want them to have both, starting with breast MRI as early as age 25, and then alternating with mammograms, once a year.
Sure.
Such that they're getting one imaging technique every 6 months. And the reason for that is we know that MRI is super sensitive for detecting breast cancer. And so we really want to reserve it to these high-risk women because they really need it.
Sure.
Those are the people you really want to make sure you don't miss anything.
So this is why the general population doesn't
have MRIs.
Have MRI. Got it. Okay. Yeah.
Unless they have some risk factor that puts them at elevated risk.
Sure.
But these mutations are really putting you at very high risk, as I mentioned with those percentages. Then we can also recommend for breast cancer, just to finish out breast cancer, there can be drugs that we can prescribe through their physician, like tamoxifen or raloxifene. And those are basically meant to decrease the risk of breast cancer because you're blocking the estrogen receptor. And the thought is that estrogen feeds the breast cells and then causes them to divide uncontrollably and form cancer. So if you can block it through these agents, they're basically just drugs that, block the estrogen receptor. And that's why it can decrease the risk. The thought is that's decreasing the risk of breast cancer, but it's not 100%. It's about a 50% risk reduction. So okay. The main risk reduction or prevention measure that we often are looking at with individuals who are at high risk for breast cancer is prophylactic mastectomy. And that basically means they're taking out the healthy breast tissue to really reduce the risk of breast cancer by about 90 to 95%.
Wow.
So for these women, it's a big surgery that takes a lot of thought before you undergo something like that. Often age and where they are in their life cycle. Do they want to have kids?
Sure.
Things like that often play, a big role before they undergo that surgery. For ovarian cancer, unfortunately, there's no good screening. So we can't.
Oh, Hedel, I was hoping you were going to say, well, 20 years ago, there wasn't.
Right? Still nothing in that front. there were a lot of studies even back then of possibilities that haven't really come to fruition. So, you know, there are screenings available, like CA125, which is a blood marker, but it's not specific and it's not sensitive enough. So, you know, it's not something we are routinely recommending. What we are recommending is, once you're done childbearing, to remove your ovaries and fallopian tubes. You know, if you do that prior to menopause, you have the added benefit of not only decreasing ovarian cancer risk by about, you know, 95 to 97%, which is great. There's also the added benefit of potentially decreasing your risk of breast cancer by almost 50%. Again, the thought being the estrogen production from the ovaries is no longer there to feed the breast cells. So those are, you know, the kind of the options currently that we offer women. There are other cancers depending on the gene and potentially even the family history and the mutation. We can recommend other screenings and for men as well. You know, we would recommend, you know, at least some sort of breast screening or self-exam and physical exam, because there is an increased risk of male breast cancer.
The topic, though, is heavy in women, especially our age now, that potentially are still childbearing.
Yes.
Right. They're not done having a family. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, want to maybe pursue that before they go ahead with genetic testing or preventative surgeries, at least where the genetic counseling really comes in. So, I mean, 85% of a chance to get breast cancer and 40 to 60% chance to get ovarian cancer. That's no laughing matter.
Right. And so that's what those are the kind of the time sensitive decisions that, you know, we think about. And often when we see patients, age is a huge factor when we're discussing these options, because there are age-related risks. And so, you know, a woman, say, who's 32, whose mom had breast cancer at 55 and aunt had ovarian cancer at 66, you know, we don't need to tell them that they need to go out and remove their breasts and ovaries tomorrow, right?
Right.
They can wait for, you know, until 40, 45, potentially, to think about risk reducing oophorectomy, removing your ovaries. Mm-hmm. And then for breast cancer, you know, we're looking at conservatively, we say 10 years younger than the youngest case in the family. So if mom was 55, then this 32-year-old
has a decade.
45. Yeah. Really kind of think about that. And so that gives them time, because I think the hardest part for a woman is, especially if they're going through, you know, potentially perimenopause, or even if they're going through thinking about, you know, having children and whether or not they want to be put into abrupt menopause, you know, after having children, surgical menopause. You know, these are all things that, you know, you really do want to utilize the age that they're at and where they are in their life cycle and work that out with them. You know, if I have a 20 or 30 year old in front of me and I don't see a lot of young breast cancer in the family, I'm trying to tell them that they have time, that they don't need to rush out and do things right away, but to kind of start planting the seed that at some point, if you do decide that, what are the things that you need to do to lead up to that decision? What are the things that you either need to work out? Are you planning on having children? If you are planning on having children, are you married yet? Do you have a partner? Is that something that you're considering actively doing sooner rather than later? Mm-hmm. You know, these are personal conversations, but I think having a sounding board with some professional, whether it's a genetic counselor, a physician, or what have you, helps them kind of work through these processes.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody would want to do this decision on their own without.
So I think those are the things that are sensitive topics that we definitely want to counsel them on. And timing, I mean, I always kind of bring it back to the life cycle, but timing of, you know, where they are, you know, in terms of thinking about kids, whether or not they're close to menopause already. You know, if they're already perimenopausal or close to being perimenopausal, then probably taking out their ovaries, you know, sooner rather than later is not going to be that bothersome to them.
Right.
It's like putting a 30-year-old in surgical menopause, right? You're not going to want to do that unless you really need to, worry that the ovarian cancer in the family is like in their 40s, which is unusual.
Okay.
That's when you are thinking, oh, wow, that's something that you need to consider. But yeah, in general, we really try to make sure that we're weighing the age-related risks. Mm-hmm. And that's why this information is important for this segment and this podcast, because I think when you think about prophylactic oophorectomy and menopause and surgical menopause and that timing factor, being educated on what perimenopause is really important, because right. It's a very definitive time point in the reproductive cycle. You know, knowing where you are in that and knowing what that means,
sure,
you know, may dictate your decisions.
And I like how you're saying that, you know, genetic counseling can help you weigh the medical information and the decisions that you have to make medically, but then also with your own goals for your life and yes. what you want, what you see happening in your future, mm-hmm. and help, you know, process that information together. Like, here's right. what I need to do for my medical well-being, but here's what I need for my mental health and, you right. know, and for my life goals, mm-hmm. and just combining all of that information. That's really yeah. important. I mean, as you said, Carla, this is a heavy conversation, but I can also see how speaking to a genetic counselor would be empowering.
Empowering. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
You have that information, and, you know, what I'm understanding from you is you're laying out the information for the patient, mm-hmm. and empowering them to make a decision based, you know, on their own needs and
their own value system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, Hedl, you're not getting out of here unscathed, because you have to share.
My OMG moment.
You have to share your OMG moment.
Well, I'll share my own, because I think what I experienced may be helpful for others. Mm-hmm. So, not too long ago, so post-COVID, well, whatever we are, where we are, yeah. but fairly recently, I finally went to my OBGYN because I moved and I didn't have one and couldn't get an appointment because of COVID. So I finally, you know, went after a couple of year hiatus. And right before I went, I basically had like bleeding between cycles, you know, which was unusual for me because I'm fairly regular. But I am older, like I am in perimenopause. But I actually asked my doctor, I said, I'm 46. And I said, you know, this is what has happened. I had this bleeding and I didn't know what it's related to because I never had it before. I said, is it worrisome? Or is it just that I'm in perimenopause? And she actually said to me, I said, is this COVID related? Because I've heard, and this was before that, like literally 2 days before that article was published, that COVID causes irregular cycles.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I suspected something weird was going on because I was experiencing some oddities and then I had this happen.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And you know your body. I mean,
yeah, you know your body. And yeah. then you hear, because girls talk, right? And they're like, oh, that happened to me. Or, you know, I have had irregular cycles. And I said, I think it's COVID. And so all of us were convinced. So I kind of threw it out there. I'm like, or is it COVID related? Because I just got over COVID not too long before that appointment. And so she said, well, it's actually not related to perimenopause. Because she said, if it was related to perimenopause, you would be missing cycles,
mm-hmm.
oh,
wouldn't okay. be getting more. So she's like, because it is, you know, abnormal, she has to work it up with the transvaginal ultrasound and all of that. So that's right. loads of fun. And so that I had to do that. But then interestingly, everything was fine. That paper came out. Like she said, actually there, you know, there is some data now. There was something that was just published, like literally days, maybe
that's crazy.
Hours after I saw her, that was published about menstrual irregularities since COVID. So definitely something to that happened to me that may have happened to others who are listening in to this, and trying to tease apart, like, what is perimenopause? What is concerning? What is COVID related? I mean, there's so many things now to be thinking about and so many reasons to be worried.
Right. There's so much on a 40-year-old something woman's plate these days.
Exactly.
But another thing that's really important is if there is an oddity and you feel like something is strange, you got to get it checked out. You can't put yourself on the back burner, because I know that's something that we tend to do. Mm-hmm. You know.
Meanwhile, my kids have gotten everything they need.
Oh, haircuts, new shoes, everything. I'm still wearing shoes from, like, you know, those pre-COVID days.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, so that was my kind of my OMG moment. It wasn't like maybe not a funny OMG moment, but an OMG moment in the sense that, you know, it's cause for concern, and you are wondering, like, what is the cause of it, and will it happen again?
But like you said at the beginning of this podcast, you know, knowledge is power.
And to trust your gut is something that you also kind of alluded to, that if you feel like something is not right, or if you feel like something, you know, is off, then consult your physician or those who you feel like who can answer your questions, some sort of medical professional, so you can get some quality answers.
I have a feeling the genetic counseling community will get a spike in
referrals
because you were our guest on here on OMG.
Yeah. No, but it's a pleasure. Yeah.
We thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule. We were just talking about how busy we all are. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
It was my pleasure, both for both. And to meet you, Kristen, is also a pleasure. And to see you, Carla, is always a pleasure. Now you have to meet in person.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks so much, Edel.
All right. Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us on today's episode.
You can listen to us on Anchor FM, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, like us.
You can contact us at perimenopauseomg@gmail.com. That's perimenopause, spelled like my last name, P-E-R-R-Y, menopause, the letters omg@gmail.com.
And follow us on Instagram and our Facebook page, at Perimenopause OMG.
Period. The end.